Welcome to Radio Oldie, brought to you by Bailey Gifford. Hello and welcome to Radio Oldie with me, Harry Mount, editor of the Oldie. And I'm delighted to be talking to Andrew Loney, the literary agent and author of the number one bestseller entitled The Rise and Fall of the House of York, about Prince Andrew and Fergie. So, Andrew, we'll go right in at the beginning. And one of your many incredible revelations is about Prince Andrew losing his virginity at the age of 11. This is quite extraordinary. What were the circumstances?
Well, the circumstances were, I'm told, a father of one of his friends took him to a brothel. I mean, it is an extraordinary story, and I was careful about whether I wanted to put it in. But I seem to have some other sources that backed it up. There were contemporaries of his at Heathertown, his prep school, who talked about sexual activity with a female member of staff. I discovered that things had been going on at Heathertown with another member of staff. So I thought it was important. It perhaps explained his sexual behaviour later on. But, you know, we did think very carefully about it, because clearly there are elements here of abuse and privacy. So the lawyers looked at it quite carefully before we went ahead with it.
And he has been to bed with thousands of women, is that right?
Well, so I'm told. I mean, yes. It's one of those very difficult things to verify. I mean, it's been widely reported in the papers. I can't say that it's something I discovered. But I certainly talked to a number of girlfriends, and that seems to be this bit like Epstein, this need for constant sexual gratification.
And might have been affected by losing the virginity so young. Part of it is obviously being royal, trying to understand his character. He was obviously indulged from a very young age.
Yeah, I think the title it sums it up. And it's very clear, looking at him, that he was the favourite of the Queen. He was spoilt. There were no boundaries. No one seemed to be able to control him. And all the way through school, university, the Navy, basically, he was protected, and he got this sense of, you know, complete impunity from any sort of control. And I think when people did try and control him, he just ran to mummy, and they were in trouble. So when ambassadors complained, for example, when he was a special trade envoy, those ambassadors suddenly found themselves posted to Lagos. When, you know, protection officers complained, they suddenly found themselves back on the beat in Brixton. So, you know, this wasn't just a problem with him. I argue that actually it was with connivance of the institution itself. And that's what was so shocking, because we'd always assumed the Queen had always put the monarchy ahead of her own family interests. And this wasn't the case.
And so presumably since her sad death in 2022, that has meant people are more likely to open up to you?
Well, I started researching the book in 2021. And what surprised me was that people were speaking quite openly, many of them on the record, many of them senior people, not just on the periphery. So, and I think they wanted the story out. I think they felt that it should come out, and they wanted it told, I think, in as fair and responsible way as possible. So, for example, I mean, I have his commanding officer in the Falklands, who's been named, his career mentor in the Navy. I mean, even former permanent undersecretaries were talking to me on the record, and a lot of ambassadors. So that gave it authority and helped. But I think, yeah, people were just tired of this story not really being covered.
Because did you find you were knocking on an open door? Because in a way, the most shocking story of all, if you could tell it to listeners who haven't read your brilliant book, is him telling off a senior courtier for getting the Queen Mother's title wrong.
Yes, he's a great believer in status. I mean, that's sort of what he relies on. I think he's searching for an identity, and there's quite a revealing comment he made, saying, I'm a prince first, a naval officer second, and a husband third. And people talk about his prince's hat. He never quite knew when to take off his prince's hat, when he was a normal naval officer and when he was being the prince. But you're absolutely right. This is a story with David Anderson at Hillsborough, who was a long-standing courtier, very loyal to the family. And there's an element of the bully in Andrew. I mean, going right back to childhood. And he just took advantage of his position to humiliate people and put them down. And because David Anderson felt that they were in familiar territory, He described Andrew's grandmother as the Queen Mother, and he insisted, you know, he said, you imbecile, you know, she should be addressed in this way. And Colin Burgess, who was an equerry to the Queen Mother, is actually very interesting. He talks about how most everyone else in the royal family treats their equerries and people as friends and colleagues, whereas Andrew treats them as sort of subordinates, as if he's bossing them around in the Navy. And he's never quite got that sort of relationship right. There's a sort of lack of empathy there, which is weird.
And to go back to his time in the Navy, it is right to say that he behaved in an admirable way during the Falklands, and he was a brave naval officer.
I mean, that's what I found. I mean, naval forums are filled with comments saying he was protected, he was never in danger. But the fact is, as his commanding officer said, we had 8 Sea Kings. We had to use them all. And they were out there. I mean, he wasn't flying over the battlefield, but he was doing what's called the milk run, taking supplies, taking troops across. But he was doing anti-submarine spotting. He was doing... there was a point where they had to do... trying to be decoys for exocets. So, I mean, it was dangerous work, dangerous conditions, much of it in the dark. And he stepped up to the mark. And I think when he was given a focus, he was very good. I think the problem then, as one officer said, is he's lazy. And at that point, he really had no sense of direction. And things began to go downhill, really, from 1983.
And is it fair to say not bright enough to actually be in charge of a ship?
Yeah, I think the problem, a lot of the resentment from his colleagues was that he was overpromoted. I mean, he did actually fail promotion to commander 3 times. He was put on a special list, not on the normal list, so it wouldn't take away from other people. Jobs were created for him later on in the Ministry of Defence, which were never replaced. But, the problem is he didn't have the application. It wasn't intelligence just, but he didn't have the leadership skills. There was a point where he may have had the command of a frigate with Tim Lawrence, taking it from Tim Lawrence, his brother-in-law. But I think the feeling was eventually that he just, Jock Slater, I think, decided as First Sea Lord that really he had to go.
And then one of the sort of tragedies of his life is, since leaving the Navy, he hasn't really found a proper job. Is that fair?
Well, they tried to give him a proper job by making him trade envoy, yeah, which they thought would focus him. I think the problem was he wasn't properly supervised. There was no, again, proper structure, whether it was the Department of Trade, the Foreign Office, the Palace, who were actually running him. And in many ways, people were saying diplomats didn't quite know why he was sent to them. The Trade Department felt they had to do something, keep him occupied. He didn't seem to know what he was doing either, often ignored his brief. And so there were moments when he could be successful, particularly in places like the Middle East. But most of the time, it was going through the motions, and people said he was actually counterproductive. And there are terrible stories of him turning up. You know, people have been planning 6 months for a particular visit, and he would decide on the day to go and play golf because it was sunny. So this sense of entitlement, which goes right back to childhood, seemed to follow him all the way through. So it's a shame, because he could have done great things. And actually, he then was involved in this thing called Pitch at the Palace, which was to bring together entrepreneurs and investors. Very worthwhile thing, actually quite successful, and really filled a gap. But he spoilt it by then setting up separately his own company in which he was making money, and then skimmed 2% off the investors' incomes, the money they gave to the entrepreneurs. So again, this is back to no one properly supervising him or him listening to people, which is why, of course, he made that terrible mistake of going on the Newsnight.
And that is going to come on to that, the world's most disastrous interview in 2019 with Emily Maitlis on Newsnight. It's true that after it, he thought it had gone very well.
Yes, he did. And even one of his equerries came up and congratulated him. But it was one, I mean, everyone had warned him not to do it, apart from his private secretary, Amanda Thirsk. And who knows why he did it. You know, there were no prescribed limits to it. It wasn't kept short. They could talk about everything. He hadn't prepared. And then he told the most obvious porkies, which were easily exposed. So he just looked ridiculous.
Well, particularly the Pizza Express.
Well, the excuse of going to the Pizza Express, the fact he couldn't sweat, that he had only gone to spend 5 days with Epstein in December 2010 just to say goodbye because it was the most honourable thing to do. There was no remorse towards the victims. Everything is seen through his own, you know, how it affects him. And so it was a car crash. And that, of course, emboldened Virginia Giuffre to bring her civil action. And that was really the beginning of the end.
And let's talk about Epstein. How did he first meet him, and did he not see any of the warning signs about him?
Well, he doesn't seem to have seen the warning signs. The line is that he'd known Ghislaine since she was at Oxford in the 80s, which this comes from a friend of Ghislaine's I talked to. My own feeling is it's more likely that Sarah Ferguson and Ghislaine Maxwell were big party figures in New York in the 90s, and they probably met. And then through, I think, the Duchess, possibly Ghislaine met Andrew. But then Ghislaine clearly saw an opportunity here to raise Epstein's status and respectability. Andrew had clearly very useful contacts from his time as a trade envoy. And for Andrew, here was someone who was getting in the jet set life, who could pay off a lot of Fergie's debts, who could introduce him to people, which is what he said in the Newsnight interview, and of course shared some of the same, shall we say, interest in women. And so it was a win-win situation for both of them. But I think they were worried. I mean, there was a point where actually Sarah Ferguson was trying to encourage him to go and stay at the flat of Lynn Forrester and Evelyn de Rothschild, so he didn't go and stay with Epstein. And because, of course, any scandal around him kind of reverberated against her and her own commercial activities in the States.
Because to talk about Fergie, it was a disastrous meeting of minds, or lack of minds, when they got married in 1986. She is as dim as he is, and as keen on money. Is that right?
Yeah, I think that was the problem. I think if he'd married Koo Stark, I think it might have been a different story. And I think that's the lesson. And Annie Wilson, I think, is absolutely right when he writes that, you know, Sophie Wessex has been the making of Prince Edward, Camilla of Charles. And I think if he'd married the right woman, I think it would have been different. But Fergie, you know, is a people pleaser. She's very generous. She has no idea about money. She was making a lot of money. I mean, that was one of the most extraordinary things, how easily she was able to make millions. But she spent it.
With her books, diets,
endorsements, yeah. You know, working for Weight Watchers, Wedgwood. In many ways, she was very effective for them. I mean, very successful. And you can't take that away from her. But at the same time, she was getting into debt at £1.5 million. And someone like Epstein was very useful in terms of trying to clear that debt. So they got drawn further and further into this sort of net. And, you know, people tried to cut back on their expenditure, and various people were brought in to do that. But, you know, she, it was a temporary thing, and off she went again.
And each time they went into debt, often it was someone dodgy like Epstein bailing them out, or somebody paying way over the odds for the house in Windsor.
Well, that's one of the scandals. I mean, you know, they'd been given this house in Sunning Hill called Tesco Towers, and they... basically, when Royal Lodge became available, he moved out of Sunning Hill and tried to sell it. It was on the market for 5 years. There was no interest in it. And suddenly, the son-in-law of the president of Kazakhstan, with whom he did a lot of business, popped up and paid £3 million more than the asking price. In fact, £8 million more than actually it was worth, according to a valuer. And everyone was slightly surprised by this. He claimed that he had been told that there was another bidder, which seems to me peculiar after 5 years of no one showing any interest. It was by that stage absolutely derelict, and in fact was going to be taken over by Bracknell Council as a hostel. So there was a sale, and it was all done through trust. No one quite knew who it was at the time. There were suggestions of money laundering, which had been rigorously denied. Another son-in-law of the president of Kazakhstan, who actually died in prison, wrote a book where he claimed it was all about basically repaying favours to Andrew. So that was a slightly suspicious operation. And there were countless cases like this, often revealed by court cases. The most famous was a case in 2022 in the High Court, a man called Selman Turk, who was being sued by a Turkish millionaireess. And it emerged in the course of the case that Andrew had been paid £750,000, which he wasn't able to explain. Sarah had £250,000, and one of the children had £25,000 put in her account. And they couldn't really account for it. So, you know, again, questions were asked about their income. I mean, certainly when I looked at the companies that they have, they have a huge range of companies that they set up, but they're all don't seem to have any transactions in them. And they are, as a result, they're not needed to be audited. And forensic accountants who looked at it thought these were very strange. But there are other accounts that Andrew has under the name of Andrew Inverness. His title is Earl of Inverness. Many of them run with a man called David Rowland, who had been...
Spotty
Rowland, yeah. Would have been treasurer of the Conservative Party, but seemed to be a little suspect for them. And he'd been entertained at Balmoral and elsewhere, and invited to weddings of the children. But he had lent money to Andrew, which didn't need to be repaid. Andrew had helped him set up banks in the Middle East. So again, and the Rowlands had been shoehorned into meetings, particularly in China, and actually the itinerary had been changed for the Rowlands to meet people they wanted to meet rather than people that actually the government felt would be useful to promote British trade. And this is why I suspect the government is so reluctant to release any of the files relating to his time as special envoy between 2001 and 2011. And some of those files under the 20-year rule should be in the National Archives. Now, I've put in, I would think, probably close to 150 FOIs over the last 4 years, and not a single one of them has produced any material. They've deployed every single exemption they can, from national security through to commercial confidentiality, personal data, health and safety, cost compliance. Often I'll put it in and they'll say they've got so much stuff that they can't, it would be too expensive to look at it. Then when I narrow it, they say that they've got nothing. So it's like a game of whack-a-mole. And this, I think, is wrong. I think, given the questions over his time there, I think, it would be good for transparency if we saw actually what he was doing, who was on these trips and who he was meeting. And was he really representing British trade? I mean, we have another case where we know that he was taking a £3.85 million commission for introducing a Greek water company to do business in Kazakhstan, organised by a Swiss finance house. So when we can find the evidence, and often it's from legal cases or whistleblowers, it doesn't look good for him. So my instinct is this is probably only the tip of the iceberg of what's been going on. I mean, there are already concerns about how Pitch at the Palace was used in China to make money for himself, using a man who's alleged to have been a spy called Tenbo Yang. And there are others that I name in the book who again are suspected of working for both the Chinese government, in fact someone else for the Russian government.
Because his legitimate forms of income are actually very limited. He's got a very small navy pension. It's not known, is that right, how much the Queen might have given him or left him, but it's alleged that she paid the £12 million for the Virginia Giuffre settlement.
Yes, I mean, the suggestions that she certainly paid his legal costs, that she may have paid the £12 million, it may have been loaned by Charles, and the money recouped from the sale for, I think, £15 million of their Swiss chalet. So we don't know, because, I mean, the royal finances are very opaque, and royal wills are sealed, even for the most minor member. So I'm told that money was passed through trust from the Queen Mother, that there may have been money from the Queen a long time before she died. She may have settled knowing that he had huge expenses like Royal Lodge before she died. So we just don't know what those trusts were. But as you say, his naval income is modest. His wife lives there. She may contribute. We don't know. I mean, she's made quite a lot of money. She has flats which have quite a large rental income. But my instinct is that this money has come from his continuing business activities in places like Kazakhstan.
Still going on.
Which is still going on.
Yeah.
We know from looking at one of the companies that money was taken out of Pitch at Palace Global and paid to him about £200,000 a couple of years ago. So we see that we can see a bit, but it's very difficult to follow the money.
And you must have a very good insight into their very peculiar marriage and divorce, that he was serially unfaithful from the beginning, and yet they still live together, and she's always very loyal to him. Can you explain how this extraordinary position has occurred?
Well, they call themselves the happiest divorced couple in the world, and they are close. They're like sort of bosom buddies. I mean, in some ways, they've had to unite against the world. He supported her when she was being criticised in the media, and she stood by him now. I think it became quite quickly an open marriage. I mean, there was a physical attraction that died quite quickly. I mean, he wasn't there. He wasn't very supportive. And so they both began, as she says in an interview, to play away. But I think it was fine. It was the Queen who forced them to divorce. She didn't like the episode of the toe sucking.
Yeah.
She felt this, you know, brought embarrassment on the royal family. So I think otherwise they would have quietly gone on with their own separate lives. But I think, you know, they wanted to co-parent. They get on well. I mean, you've got to remember that she's nothing unless she's Duchess of York and linked to him. So she did stick very closely to him. I think the Queen and Prince Philip were concerned about this. They didn't feel that emotionally he could move on. She was very good at making him feel guilty that he hadn't been a good husband. I mean, he came home and wanted to play golf and watch videos. And I think they just evolved into this sort of brother and sister relationship. They do a lot of business together. She would often, for example, hang on his coattails when he made these trips. For example, when he went to New York, the consulate complained that she would just turn up. They'd have to fit her into meetings. They were busy taking business cards the whole time. And the daughters were also taken on these trips. So it's like almost like, you know, bring your daughter to work. And they clearly picked up a nice file of facts of contacts as a result of these trade paper, taxpayer-funded trips. So it doesn't look good, the optics.
And it looks like he, Prince Andrew, for the moment has won the battle of Royal Lodge, that he will stay on there.
Yes, I don't know why they had that battle. I mean, the Queen ensured that it was very tightly tied up. He's paid, you know, he's paid for the renovation of White Lodge, Royal Lodge, and it needed a lot of work. He has more or less kept it up. I mean, I know bits of it people photograph and it's not looking too good, but which surprises me because he has the money to do it. He has a very tight lease, so there's no way he can go. I think they're trying to persuade him on his better, you know, to go because it doesn't look very good. But it's his last bit of status, and he's lived there for 20 years. I think he's hoping one of his daughters will move in there. He's got grandchildren, and they can go and play in the Wendy house. So he doesn't see why he should leave. And it's a sort of battle between the two brothers, and it's a sort of rivalry that's gone on since they were children. And it's just been played out in a slightly different form now.
And now that his mother has died and this terrible disgrace has happened, has he been essentially frozen out from the royal family? You describe a fight he had with Prince Harry, if you could enlarge on that, which I think Prince Harry has denied.
Yes, I mean, Harry has denied it. And as we all know, I think the Queen said recollections can vary. So my source, who overheard it and was there, stands by it. But it's a paragraph from the book. But I think the royal family are caught. I mean, I think Charles, you know, hits his younger brother. He's a very kind-hearted and generous man. I don't think he wants to cause ructions. I think they feel they need to keep Andrew close. They're always, and particularly Sarah Ferguson. I mean, throughout the last 30 years, she has hinted that she could release a tell-all book or talk to people. And that's always been the concern. I don't think Andrew would write a book, but you know, he could talk to someone. And there were talk, for example, that Daphne Barrick was going to do a book with him. So sort of Andrew Morton and Diana situation. So that's always the concern. Best to keep him inside the tent. And I think the interesting question is what will happen when William comes to the throne and if he will be tougher.
Because they're not close, are they?
They're not close. I mean, and he has no time for Andrew at all. So I think that, you know, in the next generation, it will be a different story. But, you know, whether people can take away more from him, I mean, he's still, I think, a vice admiral. He's still a councillor of state. He's still a knight of the garter.
In the line of succession if some terrible tragedy should happen.
Well, exactly. I mean, you know, we could have a moment where... I mean, Harry is actually even closer, but I think I'm not sure Harry can inherit because he lives abroad and he's no longer working royal. But yeah, I mean, I think Andrew certainly had dreams at one point that he might be made regent, that Charles would step down because of his marital problems, and he would, and he always thought he'd be a better king than Charles. So I think letters patent can do some of this, but whether William will want to do it. I mean, King Juan Carlos of Spain has gone off to live in Dubai. Andrew has a palace in Abu Dhabi, which was given to him by the Minna Palace. And I just wonder if a very neat solution is for him to go off there. It's nice and sunny. He can play golf. No one's going to be too interested in what he's doing. And the problem will be sidelined. And presumably Sarah Ferguson will go and live there as well.
And you referred to Charles and Andrew being quite remote from a young age. Can you see echoes with William and Harry? In fact, royal life going back through the centuries, and part of the tragedy for a younger son is that when you're born, you're second in line. Craig Brown said a very good thing about Princess Margaret, that when she was born, she was, I suppose, third in line to the throne. By the time she died, she was behind Mia Tyndall in the succession. Yep. And has that affected him, do you think, Prince Andrew, long before the disgrace, that you move further and further away from the power?
Yeah, I think it is a factor. I mean, clearly he knows that was going to be the case. And, I mean, it began quite soon. I mean, 1982 with the birth of William. But I think, you know, Edward and Anne have forged roles themselves. They don't seem to have a problem. You know, there are ways of creating identity. But you're absolutely right. They're what I call the rogue roles, the Princess Margaret's, the Harry's, the Andrew's as well, Duke of Windsor's, who kind of put their private pleasure ahead of public duty. And then there are the others who kind of just buckle down and get on with it. And so I think Andrew could have done that with the right direction and support.
And have you got a feel for his days now? I mean, he's not one of the great intellects, tremendous fan of the Muppets, nothing wrong with that, the Muppets are extremely good, but he likes crass, kind of whoopee cushion jokes and that sort of thing. How is he filling his days now?
Well, I mean, he's in effect a retired man of 65. I mean, he plays a lot of golf, he goes riding, he goes for walks, people come and see him, including his family. He's very keen on videos, particularly on airline videos. He likes watching planes land and taking off, everyone to their own. He does read a bit, actually. He does a lot of business. And funny enough, rather like Duke of Windsor, who was, you know, basically did golf and ran his investments. So I don't think it's a bad life. He has masseurs who come in and help him heal, is the term. I think he is travelling. People have talked about him going to Portugal. People have talked about him going with the Swiss billionaire's jet to Switzerland. And certainly one of the women I talked to, one of the girlfriends, said that she lived at Royal Lodge for 5 years. No one has ever revealed this or seen her come and go. So there are clearly ways of getting in and out of Royal Lodge without being noticed. I mean, people have said that he's lying in the back of a car going out with a staff member or something. So it may not be too bad, actually.
And in terms of his future, maybe that just goes on for the next 20 years?
Well, it could be longer, 30 yeah. years. You know, it isn't always a sad life. And, you know, royal status was everything to him. I mean, he enjoyed the pomp and ceremony and the respect that the position gave him. So who knows? But, you know, he gets respect in the Middle East. I mean, that may be the place to go. A lot of people reinvent themselves at that sort of age. You know, he's a man of, as you say, limited hinterland. I think, you know, possibly he's actually quite a lonely figure. I mean, it's interesting talking to people all the way through the Navy and elsewhere. He kept himself apart. He was segregated, often for security reasons, but he didn't mix with people. He didn't drink, which didn't help. So, like he said on one occasion, that one of the reasons he loved photography was he was a loner and he liked taking pictures of sort of desolate landscapes, like he told David Frost. So it is a sad life, because we do remember him as this poster boy of the monarchy and this hero from the Falklands and this man with the Robert Redford looks. So it is a tragedy, you know, how he's fallen from grace, you know, through his own stupidity and naivety.
And do you get the feeling from your sources that he feels disgraced, or actually he's such a puffed up figure, does he still think he's done no wrong?
I think that's the extraordinary thing, the people I've talked to, that there doesn't, that the feeling is he misses being, you know, Colonel in Chief of the Grenadiers or whatever, but he doesn't feel any sort of remorse for what happened. And you've got to remember, you know, he was booking Virginia Giuffre out of a catalogue, in effect, and ordering her over. And you know, Virginia Giuffre was not the only one. I mean, she's the one who came out. I mean, many of these girls, you know, signed NDAs, they've been paid off, they're now married and respectable with children, they're not going to pop up. But, you know, if you talk to the lawyers, I mean, there are a lot of women who are rather like Virginia Giuffre. But he doesn't seem to feel any sort of remorse about it. You know, his children were similar age to some of these girls at the time. It's strange to understand. But I think he just got into a world of his own, and he lacked any form of moral boundary, really.
And if we can finish by talking about how you wrote the book. You've written and spoken eloquently about how difficult it was to get access to Mountbatten's records for your biography of him. How close could you get to the centre of the royal family to get people to talk to you on or off the record?
Well, this was a very different book to my previous books, because all the others have been based on archives. And archives can lie, but I mean, it's a bit easier. And then the battles, you say, were to get access to the archives. Here, there were really no archives. It was all interviews with people. And what I did was I got off someone 6 crates of news cuttings going back to the 1980s. It took me a couple of years to actually just produce this 12-lever arch chronology of their lives. That produced about 3,000 names, and I just follow those up through the electoral roll, through social media, school lists. There are all sorts of tricks that you can use to trace people, company's house, then began to contact them. And some people led on to others. I went through, for example, the diplomatic list with all the people who would have been in situ at the time he visited. I went through LinkedIn, for example, anyone who worked for particular companies I know he dealt with, or was in Abu Dhabi, for example, at a particular time. So that produced this list, and from that, 300 people came back, and that gave me the core of the material. And then I took time to win their trust. So, you know, a lot of wining and dining. And I think people, I had an advantage. I had some family connections that knew, for example, the Fergusons. I'd been in the Naval Reserve, so I had naval connections. I'd been at prep school in Scotland, and actually some of my friends had gone on to Gordonston. One of them used to do, the scholar there used to do his homework for him. So,
because you're roughly of an age.
I was exactly the same year as him. I'm actually 2 years younger. But he went down a year. So that helped. And as a result of getting people, as you probably know from your own research, one person leads to another. And then actually since the book's come out, a lot of people come out of the woodwork prepared to talk. That I'd missed. I mean, training officers in the RAF. I'm trying to think. I mean, you know, again, people who really have something to say, and you can be trusted. I think can be trusted.
And they're less likely to clam up than they would be with a more decent member of the royal family.
Yes, I mean, I think, you know, clearly, if you were to say, you know, do a book on a queen, I think that would be a no-go area. And I wouldn't dream of doing it, but I think people felt quite strongly that he didn't bring credit on the family. He, in fact, which was my argument, that he undermines the good work that all the others do, and they need to distance themselves from him. So yeah, I didn't get any obvious case of people being pushed my way, but I suspect some people who may have asked were told that it was okay to talk to me. The Foreign Office, interestingly enough, told diplomats not to talk to me when they asked, but a lot of them just ignored that. And in fact, I did approach them and say, look, you know, I will give you a fair hearing. This is your opportunity to get your friends to talk to me. This will make it a much fuller book. You can shape the narrative. And they, for whatever reason, chose not to do so.
And you and your publishers must have taken the legal gamble that it was very unlikely that he himself was going to sue.
Well, I mean, there was a lot of stuff that they took out on him, particularly under things like privacy. I think they did take it seriously. I mean, Sarah Ferguson's lawyer had written to the publishers even before the book came out, saying, we're watching you and we're looking at you, we're looking at Andrew Loney's social media. So, I mean, the warning shot had gone out there. So I think they were quite careful. And, you know, everything had to be signed off from my interviews. They had to see the interviews. So they were, and things had to be verified. So, for example, there's a story that hasn't gone into the book, but that Sarah Ferguson was actually using Epstein's flat 5 years after she claimed to have cut all contact. And I had 3 sources, but one of them was secondhand. It was a friend of Ghislaine's. One was someone who's a neighbour, but I don't in fact pick this up off a comment in a newspaper, and I only had her sort of nickname, and she hadn't come forward, and she actually did come forward only after the book came out, and has offered to give an affidavit. So things do emerge eventually.
And there'll be more revelations in the second edition.
I hope so, yes. Yeah. So, yeah, new stuff. I mean, buy the book now because it's full of revelations, but I think there will be some more, yeah.
Well, that's a very good place to stop. Thank you so much to Andrew Loney, author of the gripping number one bestseller entitled The Rise and Fall of the House of York. You have been listening to Radio Oldie, brought to you by Bailey Gifford. Why not get 3 trial issues of the Oldie magazine for just £1? Sure you'll enjoy it. We'll then charge you £25.75 for every 6 issues. Just go to checkout.theoldie.co.uk/offers and enter old trial as one word in capitals. That's checkout.theoldie.co.uk/offers and enter old trial.